Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes. And Francis?
Good morning.
You got a really smug look on your face, like you're going to say some Weisenheimer comment.
No, I got nothing.
Oh, okay. You had that Weisenheimer comment look in your eyes.
No, I had the wincing in pain look in my eye.
How are you feeling today, man?
I'm all right. I got
a phone call from Francis yesterday. Can you come pick me up?
I got in a motorcycle accident yesterday. I got knocked off my bike on the side of Route 27 in New Brunswick, illegal left turn.
You were making an illegal left turn?
I was going straight. And then I was laying on the road. And by the way, if anyone's wondering, I'm all for helmet laws, okay? 100% for helmet laws. Anyway, I want to talk today about, do you have something you wanted to read? Oh, you had something you wanted to read.
I do. I have a quick letter from, email from one of our local listeners here in Central Jersey. His name is David. He's from South Plainfield, and he writes, I was listening to the show today regarding the Fulton Fish Market. Your guest was commenting on the fact that the mafia have not been involved since the early 80s, and, well, we don't need to talk about that. Just then, dead air into commercial break. I hope you guys are okay.
No, mafia? There's no such thing as a mafia. All of a sudden they're playing the old radio shows from the 50s.
It's a Lone Ranger for the rest of the show.
Mark and friends are on the way to the restaurant where it's burning down.
David, we're fine. Everything's okay, and they told me I could say so.
Okay, I wanted to talk seasonally about Irish whiskey. We've had a few questions recently about Irish whiskey.
Yeah.
And there was an article recently in the Times, and there've been a few articles every March around the St. Patrick's Day. There are articles, but you know it's not just for that time of year.
Mm-hmm.
And people have asked for an explanation as to what Irish whiskey is all about and what makes Irish whiskey different from other whiskey.
Hey Francis, What makes Irish whiskey different from other whiskeys?
Well, Mark, I'll tell you.
I sensed that you might.
The big controversy is between the Scots and the Irish. It goes back a long way. They both claim to be the birthplace of Usquebaugh, the water of life, and which is whiskey, of course. And the big difference between Scotch and Irish whiskey is that it used to be that the Irish whiskey held pride of place. There were more Irish whiskeys than you would find Scotch whiskeys.
Mm-hmm.
A little famine caused a bit of a problem for Irish whiskey production, and then a bunch of political conflicts caused a bunch of problems for Irish whiskey. And so Scotch has taken the pride of place, and there remain only three Irish distilleries. There are a number of brands, but they all come from three Irish distilleries. Middleton is absolutely my favorite on the high end. We're talking like $125 a bottle for Scotch.
They're very expensive for Irish.
Middleton Redbreast is...
For Irish whiskey, I mean.
And Middleton Redbreast is the only pot stilled Irish whiskey left, and if you can find that, that's very
hard to find. That's not in a lot of places.
You don't see Redbreast in this country very often. The other Irish whiskeys are not pot stilled, but what makes an Irish whiskey still to distinguish it from a Scotch is that when you have a Scotch, it's made with malted barley, and it's usually peat smoked.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is they smoke the grains before they make the whiskey, and that's what gives Scotch its taste. Yeah, that's what gives Scotch its singularly, that peat smoke peatiness. Mm-hmm. And there's a different level of peat in all the different Scotches.
Some Scotches like Laphroaig or Lagavulin or things like that have a really peaty flavor to them, and some have a much more mellow, lighter flavor to them.
And Irish whiskey, is very clean because it doesn't have that peat smoke, except for one brand called Cunamara. And that's a fairly recent development. And so when you're looking at the difference, and the big rivalry, of course, is that the Scotch say that the Irish whiskey is unfinished whiskey, and the Irish say that the Scotch is ruined whiskey. So So there you have it.
You know what, I think you're both right. Good. How's that?
Mark's going to drink wine. He's French. That's all we got. Oh, and there's also one whiskey out there that it's a one-shot production. There was whiskey that was made by the Middleton Distillery and sold to a private guy, released as Aaron Gobra. Yeah, right, okay. But Aaron, not the best name, sort of an obvious choice of name. It's called Aaron Gobra, and one-time shot, it's supposed to be amazing, and there are still a few bottles out there. And actually what Eric Asimov said in the Times article a while back, cause he said, sounds more like Brigadoon than is finding a bottle of this, because it was there, and it's gone.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of thing, and sometimes people don't realize, and we talked about this one show when we were talking about Petrus, most of these things are made in limited quantity. When you're talking about estate bottle things or small production things, there's only a certain amount of them in the world. And when they're gone, they're gone.
Yeah.
That's all there is. And you know, there's a bourbon house out there called Hirsch who only made bourbon for a short period of time. Once those bourbons are gone, they'll never be back.
Yeah. Wild, isn't it?
Yeah.
I have another little piece of news.
You do? You have news?
Yeah. We had we've had some guests from Star Chefs, mm-hmm. which is the StarChefs.com is a great.
We had Antoinette Bruno on. She was
Antoinette
great.
Bruno, who's the director of Star Chefs on, as a matter of fact. And Star Chefs is a great culinary website for mm-hmm. both professionals and for consumers. And if you really want to know what's going on,
there's a lot of information on the website.
Well, they do every year. They pick four cities and they do their mm-hmm. Rising Stars Awards.
Yeah, I saw this article.
What's interesting about the Rising Star Awards is they nominate top chefs in different categories. But there's a new category, and the category here is Bar Chef.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Bar Chef is it's a bartender, and we've talked about cocktails a lot in the past, and we've had on Dale DeGroff.
That's because we like cocktails.
I love cocktails. And actually, one of the gentlemen we're going to have later in the show, we're having a couple of guests for the rest of the show on from Slow Food USA. We're having one of the co-chairman of the board and the executive director. And actually, the co-chairman of the board has a cocktail background, as a matter of fact. He's very interested in that. But I think it's very interesting that Star Chefs now has, along with chefs of various stripes, and sommelier, there's also bar chef or bartender. And the idea of these bartenders is not that they know how to make, you know, a fuzzy wuzzy woo-woo and a mm-hmm. mudslide. It's that these bar chefs, to be nominated, you need to be able to understand drinks from the golden era of the cocktail.
Right.
Know where...
You have to be a little bit of a historian.
Because you have to know where stuff comes from.
Where it comes from.
You have to know your product very well, so you have to be a bit of a spirits expert. But you also have to...
Like a chef, you need to be able to mix these ingredients together and see what goes with what and what's out of line. And
make new stuff.
Make new stuff. Just like food, though, if you put too much stuff in that pot,
right.
It doesn't matter how tasty the ingredients are going in. If you over-muddle it, if you do too much to it, it's not going to taste very good.
Making cocktails is like cooking. And that's why we have, for the cocktail program that we've developed for our restaurant, Catherine Lombardi, Chef and I were behind the bar mm-hmm. with the maitre d' from upstairs, and we took a bunch of classic recipes that we know from our friends Dale DeGroff and Audrey Saunders and... But we created our own drinks
right.
and refined those old recipes because a recipe is nothing but a loose guidebook. And so I think it's really great that Star Chefs has added Bar Chef to their category of Rising Stars.
It's part of that full-service restaurant thing that you're looking for from the great places.
And the Bar Chef is a guy named John Gertzen from Number 9 Park. So congratulations to him. Listen, when we come back, we're going to be talking to the folks from Slow Food USA about Slow Food, which is an organization we belong to and you need to know about. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Shada, stage left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Today we're going to be talking about Slow Food. Slow Food is an international organization. That's
like snails and stuff?
No. The probably. But Slow Food is an international organization that is trying to help effect a broad cultural shift away from the destructive industrial ways of food production by which most of our food is currently produced and the destructive ways of food consumption. Read fast food, by which we consume it. Alan Katz is co-chairman of Slow Food USA Board of Directors and a noted authority on spirits. He's the founder of the New York Convivium of Slow Food, which is the largest in the nation with over 1,000 members. And Erica Lesser is the executive director of Slow Food USA. She's responsible for the American branch of Slow Food, an organization started in Italy with over 14,000 members in the United States. Hey, guys. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Hey, nice to have you guys here. Welcome to the show.
In the spirit of full disclosure, we have to let it be known that Mark and I are members of Slow Food USA, so we're biased completely.
Here's to you.
Glad to hear it.
Well, you know, why don't I start out with a couple of questions for the two of you guys, and I want to let everyone in the audience know that this is a consumer-driven, a community-driven organization. It's the membership is worthwhile in a million different ways, and if you want to learn how to join Slow Food USA, you can go to our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll link you there. It's a lot of fun stuff going on there. But Erica, why don't you tell us how Slow Food got started in Italy? And Alan, since I know you started the largest U.S. convivium in New York, and then you can maybe tell us how it came to America.
Great. Well, people are always interested in the origins of Slow Food and especially how we got our name. And it comes from a story that's kind of turned into a sort of mythical proportions over the years, but it has some basis in reality. Basically, what happened in the mid-80s, the first McDonald's restaurant was about to be opened in Europe, the first restaurant in Europe, right in front of the Spanish Steps in Rome. And anyone who's ever been to Rome, and even if you haven't, I mean, it's this beautiful, iconic social gathering point, architecturally beautiful and historic part of the city. And McDonald's was about to come in and build their Golden Arches right next to it. And this caused an incredible outrage on the part of the Italian public, and in particular on the part of a lot of people who were involved in the media, involved in thinking about and promoting food and wine and protecting this very important part of Italian culture, food and wine. And so they organized a protest and brought everybody they could find, cooked up a huge mess of pasta, and basically staged a joyful protest outside of the new McDonald's and offered a plate of pasta to anyone who would come and stand with them instead of going into the restaurant. And they chanted, "We don't want fast food, we want slow food." And that's where the name came from.
That's so, the thing about us restaurant people, or we restaurant people, we don't just hold a protest, we feed you while we're doing it.
That's right, that's
well,
right.
Well, so did the McDonald's survive?
The McDonald's is still there.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually been there. I went and I had to see it with my own eyes, so I went a few years ago when I was passing through Rome. But they succeeded in not allowing the Golden Arches.
Oh, that's great.
To be outside, so it's just kind of etched in the limestone
mm-hmm.
above
the face of the building.
The restaurant, yeah. But McDonald's is there. We know that the industrial food system has an incredible hold on our global eating habits and the global economy, but Slow Food is also proud to show its own growth and its
all
own
all right, so we go from there to we yep. want Slow Food, and then how is Slow Food formed, and what's its purpose initially, and how does it come to be?
Well, it started out initially as a group of people who were really concerned with preserving the slow life and the slow meal, literally. So long lunches, good food, good wine. But it wasn't long before they realized, you know what, it's not enough to just enjoy our food and to choose quality above all else. We also have to understand where it's coming from and be responsible for the food source. And that's when we became an eco-gastronomic organization, the idea being that you can't be a gastronome without understanding the ecological, the environmental consequences of the food we eat, because if you do, you're just a glutton.
I just want to interject what
sure.
I want to sort of bring down exactly what it is that we're talking about. The idea is not that, you know, the best food, it's not about snobbery. You know, it's not about, oh, I want to have the best truffles and caviar, and that's all really I'm concerned about.
Well, I like having the best truffles and caviar.
Well, sure, if you're buying. But the idea is to have good taste is to make a statement, is to be revolutionary. I mean, food in so many cultures brings people together, and it's not just purchased out of a box in the supermarket. And the idea of fast food is, it's like you said, Erica, to come together over a meal and build a community and sit with your kids or sit with your friends. And that's really under assault. And we've lost a lot of that battle in the United States. But in Europe, that battle's still being fought. I mean, there's a war on the siesta in Spain. There's a, you know, as international companies come in, they don't want to abide by local customs. And I think it's important that people make that connection between sourcing great food, keeping the methods of production of great food alive, and being able to eat it. I mean, is that the connection there?
Yes, and that's what we mean by being eco-gastronomic, that you have to combine knowing where your food comes from with a commitment to enjoying it and to gathering the people that you know and love around the table with you. So that's what we evolved into over the years, and now our mantra, our goal, and it's a pretty ambitious one, but our goal is to promote and bring about a food system that is good, meaning that it tastes good and it gives you pleasure and it's high quality, that it's clean, meaning that it's environmentally sound, and that it's fair, which is an issue that we still have yet to deal with in a really meaningful way in the United States, but is being dealt with starting to anyway in other parts of the world, which is about paying farmers a living wage.
You know, and the thing about it is it's keeping the farmers on the farm and making sure that in order to be a farmer, you don't have to own miles and miles of land. Hey, listen, when we come back, we're going to be talking more with Erica Lasser, and we're going to be talking with Alan Katz about how slow food came to the United States and how you can get involved in it in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And our guests today are Erica Lasser, the Executive Director of Slow Food USA, and Alan Katz, the Co-Chairman of the Board of that organization.
So, Alan, why don't you tell us how Slow Food came to the United States? How did this organization get started here?
Well, timing came together very well in the late 90s with, very honestly, a good economy and experience that a lot of people had an opportunity to travel to Europe to have a very intimate experience and understanding of, if you will, the values of a slow life. And the brilliance of Slow Food internationally is that the namesake is in English.
Mm-hmm.
And as the creators of fast food, slow food is essential in the United States if there's going to be a true global change in our food culture, our food system, and our appreciation for how food comes to the table. And so all of those issues combined, those tactics combined, if you will, really came to a confluence in the late 90s. And, in fact, Erica was part of the group that originally launched Slow Food back in 99, 2000, with a small shoestring staff, but big goals and grassroots efforts that very quickly moved out from New York across the country into groups large and small.
I'll tell you, it's wonderful for us. We found Slow Food for the first time. We were in Italy together. We were on a wine buying trip, and we were in Verona, and we were at a fair called Vin Italy, which is a conference that they have there. And Slow Food had a big
must have been 99.
They had a big area set up, and we thought, Slow Food, that's great. I love it. And then when it came to the United States, we were pretty happy to get involved in it. You know, we only have a minute or so left in the segment, but will you tell people what kind of benefits they would get? I mean, this is not an advertisement on your behalf, but you do some really interesting things for your members. One of the things you do is a lot of publications come the way of memberships. What kind of publications can people receive by joining?
Well, we have two. We have our national publication, The Snail, which is both a report on all the unique events from the slow food perspective that take place both locally and around the country, but also reports on related and similar ideas, events, and opportunities around the world. And then the long-standing international magazine of the movement, which is called Slow, which is a three-times annually magazine that's both a philosophic publication, artistic publication.
Hey, tons of great information in there.
If you want to find out more, you go to restaurantguysradio.com and you can find out more. We'll be back after the news talking with the co-chairman and the executive director of Slow Food USA. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Slow Food is an international organization. It's an eco-gastronomic organization that Mark and I have belonged to for years and wholeheartedly support. Their co-chairman is Alan Katz, and Erica Lesser is their executive director. They join us today to talk about Slow Food USA, that you can get involved in this organization. They have all kinds of neat events that you can go to. If you join, they have tremendous publications that, frankly, I'll tell you, Erica and Alan, a lot of our shows are prompted from Slow Food publications.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal clearinghouse for what's really important about food. One of the things that we got involved on early with you sort of single-handedly started a movement. You have an ARC project that you started with Heritage Turkeys, and that's really taken fire. Will you tell us
what that is.
About that.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. Well, the ARC of Taste is like a lot of slow food things. It comes from a story, and the idea is that there are foods that are at risk of disappearing in this world. They're good tasting, amazing examples of traditional, you know, cooking traditions and food making traditions, but they just can't compete in an industrial marketplace. And so literally they are at risk of being swept away by the flood of industrialization, and that's kind of where the idea of the metaphor of the ark came from, that it's protecting these foods from the flood of a modern day situation.
So when you say protecting food, you mean like taking animals that might go extinct and creating a demand for eating them?
Exactly. Because you have to eat it to save it.
Every time Francis and I talk about this, we get emails like, "You guys are nuts. What are you talking about?
That turkey's endangered.
How are you going to eat turkeys and save them from being endangered?" And it's strictly financial. It's strictly make it in the best interest of people to breed these animals. And what will happen is they will breed these animals and they will continue to thrive.
Let me lay out the land. Let me lay out the lay of the land there for how this works. The broad-breasted white turkey, which is the commercial agribusiness turkey that you buy for 9 cents a pound or 19 cents a pound around Thanksgiving time. Before that, that's the easiest and most convenient way to mass market flavorless turkey. Before that, you had all different regional kinds of turkeys that you would have in the United States that were raised on farms and would, you know, walk around on the farm and hunt and peck. That's a very expensive way to raise a turkey.
Right.
And how bad had it gotten? I mean, how many turkeys were how close were they to extinction?
Very close. There were probably about 1,500 birds left in maybe four or five breeding flocks, and this was all of the most rare endangered breeds in the United States. So there were practically none. A really bad tornado going across Kansas, or, you know, that could have wiped out most of them.
You know, and it's funny because people don't realize that this modern agribusiness food, the fast food, it does impact. It does hurt. We do need to work to preserve our traditional ways of food because it's not, you know, it sort of gives you this illusion of choice, but it takes away your choice in the long term if you don't preserve your heritage.
Agribusiness crowds out other foods. It crowds out other farmers. If we don't watch out for those people, then we're going to have a long-term problem.
So how do you create demand for these products, and how do consumers get their hands on these things, and how did you have such success with turkeys, and what's the level of success you've had with turkeys?
Well, turkeys, we've had phenomenal success, kind of like a runaway freight train, actually. So it's been really exciting to see. But basically, we went from 1,500 breeding birds to there's probably 5,000 or 10,000 breeding birds out there now because the demand has just exploded in the marketplace. We started out with about 15 or 20 farmers across the country and said, listen, if you feed these birds well, if you raise these particular breeds, we will guarantee you a market because we have members, 14,000 members across the country, and we knew that our members would love the opportunity to have these birds on their Thanksgiving tables.
And we sell them in the restaurant. We use heritage breeds every Thanksgiving in the restaurant, and I use them in my family's Thanksgiving dinner, and they're amazing. You know, the thing about all these crazy tricks about how you inject birds and deep fry them to make them flavorful, that's because these modern birds are terrible. You know what you do with a heritage bird? You put it in the oven, you cook it. It's delicious.
Exactly, exactly. That's all you need to do. So a lot of what we've ended up doing is promotion, literally, trying to bring publicity, get journalists to write about these foods, taste them, promote them to a wider public. Another part of what we're trying to do, which is really focused work projects that we call Presidia, which is about bringing in an active kind of protective support to producers, is by encouraging them to form small local cooperatives where they work with each other to improve the quality of the production, to develop a brand identity, and to start eking out niche markets of their own so they don't need us in the long run. We're just trying to give them a jump start in the beginning.
I think the key thing you said there is you bring people together to taste these foods, and there's almost no one that I've tasted either heritage breeds of pork or turkey
or polenta or corn
polenta or chicken, any of these things that I've brought to people where they don't go, wow, what is this? Where'd it come from? Oh, my goodness.
You know, every time you look at a commercial for some canned jar of spaghetti sauce that's made in a factory in Rahway, you know, the mother-in-law opens the can and the daughter-in-law opens the can and the mother-in-law puts her finger and she says, ah, that's Italian. No, it's not. It's from Rahway. You want to cook a tomato, you can have the Italian. You know, listen, one of the things I really like about your organization, and we've sort of hinted at it a number of different ways, is you really do create communities. It's I've been to a bunch of the New York events. I was to a slow beer event in New York. I was to a barbecue in New York. And, boy, when people come together who love great food and wine and to share great food and wine, I mean, it's tremendous. Do you find that people get active in the community? How do people participate? Do they just sort of sign up and pay their dues and buy a turkey once in a while, or are they going to things?
Well, that's a way to start.
Uh-huh.
But there are different levels. It's like any community. There are certain people who have more interest, more time, more personal stake, if you will, and choose to get more involved like any non-for-profit organization. And that's what's been really extraordinary, not only with projects like the ARC and Presidia, but in actually developing and growing Convivia or chapters locally and around the country.
So, Alan, as the mayor of this little community, tell us about what's going on in New York these days.
Well, we've become extraordinarily active in the last few years. In 2005, we hosted 14 events, all on a volunteer basis. The most recent event was actually a wonderful benefit on Fat Tuesday to support a national initiative from Slow Food USA to support local farmers down in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast who've been so devastated by Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
But most of our events are really about the umbrella theme of taste education. There is always a gastronomic component of tasting, of experiencing, a hands-on component, but with a true educational takeaway that's not only, we hope, of value to the member, the participant that attends, but that they can share with their community outside of Slow Food, their family, their coworkers, their friends.
Do you know what Slow
Food? There's a greater influence.
Do you know what Slow Food really embodies? And what I really like about these events, it does build a community on a very local level. When we talk about, you know, we talk about doing good, we talk about keeping these products alive and these birds alive and these breeds alive and these methods alive. The way that Slow Food does it is it brings people together to enjoy themselves, you know. And we're not asking you to go knock on doors and pick up garbage in the neighborhood. We're saying go out and drink some great beer. Or have a great piece of turkey and come together and do it. And they're fun, man. I mean,
I would just add, it need not be sophisticated. There's very much a social component, both literally and as being a member of a close-knit society and part of a larger national or global community interested in the same values.
Yeah, you know, and I have to say, we're talking sort of highfalutin here, and I agree with all of those things, but, you know, go to the Slow Beer event and just have a couple of beers and chat with people. It's just
a ton of fun.
We're talking with the co-chairman and the executive director of Slow Food USA. We're going to tell you how to join that organization, and which you should do, and we'll be talking more with them in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Catherine Lombardi and Stage Left Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And our guests today are Alan Katz, who's co-chairman of the board of Slow Food USA, and Erica Lasser, who's the executive director of Slow Food USA. Now, either one of you guys can talk about this, but you have an organization coming up, or the Slow Food has an organization coming up called Terra Madre, which is pretty interesting. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, Terra Madre is a global network of small-scale farmers and food producers from literally all over the world. It was first brought together at a conference in 2004. We brought together 5,000 food producers from 130 countries, including over 500 farmers and food producers from the United States. And it was a meeting 4 days long just to come together as a group and talk about problems that small-scale producers from around the world face, issues that they share, challenges, and successes that they also need to share, because there's no one really speaking for the small-scale food producer on a global level. And so that's the thing we tried to do, was to create a space for people to do that. It'll be happening again this fall, and it'll again be in Italy, if I didn't mention that before. It happens at the same time as the Salone del Gusto, which is Slow Food's gargantuan food fair, which is open to the public, attracts over 150,000 people over 5 days.
And where in Italy is this?
It'll be in Turin.
A little post-Olympic event.
That's right.
By the way, if you guys want to go pig out, this is the place to go. So tell us when.
It'll be October 26th to 30th of this fall. And Terra Madre is, it's not just a conference, it's a network, as I said before, but because this is only our second time organizing it, our focus is really on identifying farmers and food producers in local communities all over the country who are really good examples of people who are really working towards the goals of sustainability and flavor combined together.
Can we talk about some of those programs that are going on around the country, the, you know, Plant 1,000 Gardens program, things like that?
Sure. Well, as you may have noticed on our website, we have nearly 150 convivia. New York City is the largest, but we have many, many smaller groups in small, medium, large cities around the country. And they organize many projects on a local level, which include garden projects and other kinds of children's gardening and education that falls under our national program, Slow Food in Schools. And what we were talking about before, the Arc of Taste projects, things like heritage turkeys, is something that our local chapters have taken on with gusto. And so they're promoting everything from the Cape May salt oyster, which you guys have probably tasted.
Oh, yeah.
To raw milk cheeses, which are made by a fantastic handful of small-scale cheese producers around the country, to the Gravenstein apple of Sonoma County. That's a new project that we're working on to preserve this historic variety, which has, it actually came, it wasn't historically linked originally with California, but it came as a small industry to Sonoma County and now is being threatened by the monoculture of grape growing out there.
I think it's great that to see all the different, I mean, you see even in your supermarket now, you're seeing different varieties of apples than you've ever seen before because of these types of movements. I just want to go back it for just one second. Why do you think that having kids have a garden in school, what do you think that teaches them? What do they take from that?
Well, kids nowadays have no idea where their food comes from. And, you know, we think that that has a big role in the incredible obesity epidemic and the incidence of diabetes that we see in kids all across the country now. That if you don't understand what your food is, where it comes from, how it got to your plate, there's no sense of the healthiness of it, of the freshness, of its wholesomeness, and of the chance that you have for good flavor.
You know, it's interesting because the more you listen to commercials, you know, Apple Jacks sort of come from a magic place, and there is no king who makes a burger, nor does a clown. You know,
it's magic, all right.
But the idea of that is to obscure where food comes from, and the more that you know that food comes at certain times. You know, you get tomatoes in August in New Jersey. I mean, the better and healthier you're going to eat. I mean, to eat whole foods is so important, and to teach kids that, I give you guys a lot of credit for that. Hey, listen, we have a lot of members I have listeners. We have a lot of listeners who listen across the country and internationally. And if someone wanted to start a Convivia of slow food, how would they go about doing it? Could they contact you?
Yes, they just come to our website, slowfoodusa.org, and send us a message, and we can start talking to them and getting them started up.
And that can be as little as 5 or 10 friends getting together to grow a community garden and eat some really good food. Isn't that correct?
That's right.
I think that's a pretty happening thing to do. And you can find out more about Slow Food USA, Tara Madri, some international traveler, what you can do in your community if you link to them through our website at restaurantguysradio.com. Mark and I have been members for a long time, and we've attended events in Europe and in the United States, and we think you guys are great.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, please keep up the great work. I mean,
you
it's
too.
So important.
Erica and Alan, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Super.
Thanks
Take
very
care.
Much, guys.
That was Alan Katz, who's co-chairman of Slow Food USA Board of Directors, and Erica Lester, the executive director of Slow Food USA. And, Mark, these things, I know I've been doing some of them more than you. I mean, we both get involved in the restaurant. Mm-hmm. Our restaurant, we purchased a lot of stuff, and we sourced. We found a lot of products and small producers through them. And if you're a gourmand,
I mean,
they even
tied us to some local farmers that are within 10 miles of us.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We found through Slow Food.
Well, we buy Heritage Turkeys every year, mm-hmm. but we got involved in Heritage Turkeys through the ARC
Heritage
project.
Heritage Turkeys came through Slow Food, yeah.
But how they started it, just so you know how innovative these folks are, they convinced us, or the restaurant buyers, to put a down payment on the chicks in the spring so the farmer would be able to grow enough chicks to use to buy your Heritage Turkeys in the spring. And I think that's super and innovative and important. And
well, it's a cooperative effort. And one of the things that we as restaurant owners have learned, and I think that people are learning in their own gardens and backyards, is if you invest a little bit of time, if you invest a little bit of energy into this, and sometimes if you invest a little bit of money into it, there are huge rewards that you reap from it.
Slow Food USA, the magazines are great. The events, especially I can speak around the New York events, are awesome. They're great ways to meet like-minded people, and they're fun. I mean, we're talking about a lot of highfalutin ideals behind it, but it's basically a reason to get together and have a party as well. So you should check that out, Slow Food USA. Link to our website. We'll talk to you more in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Labarty Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guests today were from Slow Food USA, which is an organization that you should join if you just like to sit at home and read. They got great stuff. If you want to know where to buy great food, they got great stuff. And if you want to come out and meet people, they got great events, especially in the New York area.
Now listen, it's all snails and turtles. No ostrich or roadrunner here.
What?
Slow Food.
Oh, God. That's
horrible. You really didn't get that.
No, I thought you were smarter. I'll never make that mistake again. Yeah, Slow Food USA is really great. And you know what? I'll tell you something. It's a great place to meet people. If you're new to town and there's a Slow Food Convivia in town, their events are totally laid back. Usually don't need to be a member to go, but it's usually, $20 for members,
and those
30
of you in
bucks
Central
for
Jersey, non-members. Slow Food already exists here. So
yeah, there's Slow Food
if you're in the listening
here.
Area.
And you can take advantage of both here and in New York City. Mm-hmm. And the New York City one is just I live in Jersey City, so I'm right next to it. And I think they're great. They're great ways to meet people. Heritage Foods USA is an organization. It's a clearinghouse for a lot of the foods that Slow Foods talks about. And actually, the founders are from Slow Foods, and we do a lot of business with them. They have an interesting product that I thought we'd bring up. This really makes a lot of sense. They deal with a lot of bison, a lot of buffalo meat. And one of their producers of buffalo meat has started tanning buffalo hides and making buffalo leather products. And so you can now get, if you go to heritagefoodsusa.com, you can link to them, find the link for them on our website. You can get a shoulder bag, a tote bag, a writing portfolio, a notepad and cover. I'm not so big on the leather notepad and cover. But the shoulder bag and the backpack look really cool. Now, the backpack's like $400.
But it would be antithetical to this whole organization to not think that they were going to use the whole product, that they were going to use the whole buffalo, that they were going to use the whole animal.
And if you look historically, bison is way superior to cow leather, but it just hasn't been around for that much in the last 50, 100 years. Two outstanding attributes make bison leather superior to cowhide: suppleness and strength. If you look, bison leather's flexibility is determined by the number of hair follicles on the hide. Bison has 200 times the hair follicles per square inch as cow leather. This stuff is durable, and it's beautiful, and it's great, and you can find out about that at Heritage USA.
Those are the things that make me superior to you, too.
What's that?
Suppleness and strength.
Oh, my goodness. That's enough. I've had just about enough of you. This is Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.